At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.
Welcome to Killer Podcast. I am your host, David, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Craig. How are you doing, sir?
I am doing outstanding, sir. How are you?
I'm phenomenal. We are back, baby.
Yes, sir.
It's about time.
Hey, only 5 years. I mean, that's not that big of a gap, right?
No, nothing's changed at all. When we left, Trump was president. When we came back, Trump was president.
Yeah. We better steer clear of that topic, though.
No, I'm not bringing politics into it. It's more of a timeline kind of thing, since he was in and then out of office and then back in again.
Yeah, very true.
Yeah, that's pretty wild, man. But yeah, it's been a hot minute. So, you know, for those of you longtime listeners who stuck around and kept us in your subscription feed, thank you so much. We are sorry we left for so long, but I guess quick rundown before we get started. So this intro is probably gonna be a little bit more chatty than ones in the future here, but for those who care, you know, Craig and I stopped recording, I don't know, what was it, like August 2020 or something like that? It was a long time ago.
Yeah, it's been 2020 since we've actually recorded any kind of content or anything. Or, I mean, it's almost been 5 years since we've even spoken about redoing the show.
Yeah. And for me, you know, right around that time, just before that, I just had a newborn. And, you know, so things were getting quite hectic with the newborn, with the job, COVID, all that stuff was going on. Like, it was just a wild time. And frankly, I got burnt out, and I think you did too, right?
Yeah, to some extent, yeah. There was a lot of burnout there, and we were trying to crank out so many cases, you know, one a week, and just with all the work involved with recording and editing, and it just got to be a lot. And like you said, you know, the reality of life hit us pretty hard, and lots of things going on, and just got put on the bookshelf for a while. But, you know, I'm glad we're back. I'm glad we're getting this resurgence going, and I'm excited about what's to come.
Yeah, same here. And so on that note, we'll stop boring you with our personal details. In terms of the show, though, I will say we probably will not be a weekly episodic show for a while, if at all. And the reason is I really felt like at the end there, part of what the burnout was trying to pump out new cases so quickly. And then, you know, if you'd run into a dead end on researching something and come up with the next one, you know, just to try to like slot those in and move them as quickly as possible was becoming very difficult to do. And I felt like the quality for me, at least, was starting to dip, and it was dipping in a way that I wasn't happy with. So, you know, and I didn't think was sustainable. So in this case, you know, we're going to try to bunch up recordings for us and or multi-part series and pump them out that way. So maybe it'll buy us some time. So you might see some weekly, but there could be gaps in there, I guess, is all I'm trying to say. And so just, you know that we will warn you if we're going dormant, but I don't plan on it anytime soon. I love doing the show, and I know Craig does too. So you know, thank you guys for sticking around. And for those of you who are new and are stumbling upon us, yeah, we are glad you're here, and look forward to talking some true crime with you guys.
Yeah, and I'll echo your sentiment and just very appreciative that for those of you that stuck around, I mean, we still look at some of our metrics that are out there, and we're still getting a few handful of downloads, but you know, we're looking to come back with lots of great content. We want to keep the quality high, and we want to keep moving forward. And I think we've got a lot of interesting things on our plate to share with everyone as we move forward.
Yes, sir. So that being said, you want to get us started?
Yep. Just a quick note before we get started here. Most of these new cases that we're going to be recording and sharing with everyone, we're going to be adding chapter markers for podcast players. So if you hate the segments here at the beginning of us listening to the sweet sounds of our voices during the intro, you can always skip right to the guts of the case. So again, thanks for listening, and please share us with your friends.
Real quick, don't forget, hit our website. It's new and improved, and it's a little different than what it was in the past, right? So killerpodcast.org. You can go check us out there. And don't forget, we have a Patreon. So if you would be so kind as to buy us a cup of coffee, we'd appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, you ready to kick things off?
Yes, sir. Let's do it.
All right. You're listening to Killer. This is Delphi, the trial of Richard Allen.
Lock your doors, bolt your windows, and turn off the lights. We're about to begin.
February 13th, 2017, Delphi, Indiana. Best friends, Abigail Abby Williams and Liberty Libby German, have a day off from school, coming up on Monday, February 13th. The winter had been unseasonably warm, so the school used a calamity day on the 13th to allow the kids an extra day off. The friends spent the night together at Libby's home, the home of her grandparents, Mike and Becky Patty, on Sunday night, February 12th. The afternoon of February 13th, the girls asked if they could go hike the Monanhai Bridge, a place familiar to Libby and her sister, Kelsey. Kelsey recalled that day, remembering her sister asking to go with them to the high bridge. Kelsey initially declined, but felt guilty as she had recently been neglecting to spend time with her sister, so she had second thoughts and decided to offer to drop her off if they could get a ride home. Libby's grandmother gave the girls permission to go, so Libby called her father, Derek German, to coordinate picking the girls up. He agreed and said that he'd meet them around 3 to 3:30 p.m. The girls hopped in the car, and at approximately 1:43 p.m., a Snapchat was posted depicting a selfie of the girls in the car on their way to the trails. At around 2:05 p.m., another Snapchat is made, a photo of the Monanhai Bridge, a bridge that hasn't seen a train crossing its rails since the 1980s. An impressive structure, 63 feet above Deer Creek, the now abandoned bridge that once saw Monan Rail Company trains crossing its path, has now become a local hiking spot for those brave people to cross its worn and weathered path. The surrounding terrain has its share of hills and valleys, hiking trails, water, and of course, the aforementioned bridge. As the girls were enjoying the scenic small-town hiking spot, they continued doing what a lot of kids do these days, post a snap. A couple minutes later, at 2:07 p.m., there's another post made, this time a photo of Abby on the bridge. And at 2:13 p.m., there's a 43-second recording of Abby on the bridge. The public has seen snippets of this video, but it has not been released in its entirety. In the video, there's grainy footage of a man wearing what appears to be blue jeans and a blue Carhartt or workman's jacket. He was headed toward the girls during the video. It's unclear if it was taken because the girls were sensing strange behavior of the man or if it was just part of their fun day. But it would capture one of the most important pieces of evidence, a video that would depict the soon-to-be killer, eventually known as Bridge Guy. It's also reported that one of the girls says, "Gun!" And then you hear the now infamous audio, which has become a moniker of sorts attached to the case since its release.
So I find it interesting with what you shared there on the day that Libby's sister dropped them off at the bridge, you know, a pretty popular hiking spot for, you know, residents in that area. And the point was brought up. I heard, you know, the same information in some of the press conference information. And it's one thing that stuck with me listening to all of the audio that we've gathered on this case was not to put blame towards Kelsey, but it's too bad that she didn't stick around with the girls that day. You know, how would things have been different if there would have been one more older sibling there, you know, to keep an eye on them, especially, you know, later in the day or during their hike when they were approached by the bridge guy.
Yeah. And that's the thing. You know, Kelsey was speaking in an interview where I, you know, captured some of that information that, you know, I just read out there. And, you know, she was saying, you know, she hadn't really spent a lot of time with her sister, you know, and her sister would always ask her to hang out. But it's one of those things, you know, you get to that age where your older sibling is just busy with their life. You know, there's that weird stage or circle of life where, you know, siblings are real close, then they grow apart while they're kind of becoming their own, and then they come back together on the other side, you know, usually into adulthood once, you know, they're into their either their careers or through college or what have you. And doesn't mean they're not close during that time, but a lot of families, that's kind of the cycle depending on the age gaps. And it's unfortunate that Kelsey wasn't there, because you have to wonder if there's a third person. Does Bridge Guy, you know, have the guts to go up and try to make this happen?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, seeing them with an older sibling, he may have been deterred, and he may have strolled right past him on the bridge and said to himself, maybe I'll wait on the next victim to come along. You know, I don't know that it was anything that was premeditated. I think it, you know, by all accounts, maybe it was just those girls were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And you have to believe that, and to no fault of her own, Kelsey's living with some kind of guilt there by dropping them off and what happened. I can't imagine, you know, what kind of weight that puts on you as an older sibling to have something like that happen to your younger sister.
Of course, you know, you think of all those little things, you know, in your head and the timing of things. And if you were just, you know, a minute or two different, you know, plus or minus, like what the outcomes are, you know, in certain situations, it's wild. It's something that you just, you'd have to wrestle with for your whole life, but you'd also have to understand she had no idea what was going to happen to her sister, you know? And of course you feel guilty, but you also have to have some form of just understanding the situation. Like, yeah, it's awful. And yeah, if you didn't take them there that day, it doesn't happen. But at the same time, like, this just doesn't happen. This isn't something that most people worry about on their, you know, day-to-day basis. And so, you know, as much as you could say it, I don't know that she could feel it, but, you know, she should not feel guilty at all about taking her sister and her friend, you know, to go hike the trails that day. There's a psychopath that was there, you know, it wasn't something that you could predict. And quite frankly, it'd be a pretty miserable existence if that's how everyone lived their lives, right. You know, just always in fear.
Absolutely. And I'm sure it's something that she had done in the past. It's probably something common, you know, little sister needed a ride with her friend somewhere, dropped her off. I mean, it could have been anywhere. It just happened to be the hiking trail on the Monin Bridge that day. I mean, it could have happened any place, any time. It's just one of those things where everything lined up, you know, for the worst. And you have to come to the realization that there's nothing it could have been different, or you're not at fault for that happening.
Yeah, right. And the crazy part about this case, and we'll get into a lot of detail here. I know we've already covered this, you know, I think it was episode 19 or something back several years ago at this point, but it's worth rehashing, because one of the things that we'll find as we kind of recap here, the happenings of the case that kind of kicks us off to where we end up. Once we get through this and the girls are found and things, like, basically there's nothing after that, like, for years. You just don't get much more information. There's a few things the police share with the public, but generally speaking, you don't get a lot of information. And that's actually why I wanted to cover this again. And it's because now that the trial has taken place, and we'll get there, you know, a lot of information was given in the trial. And I just found it very interesting to hear how things went down. you know, what the police are saying, you know, is the way that this happened versus all the speculation, you know, for years, right?
Just as David mentioned, we're going to do a brief recap of the day and the events that followed just to bring everybody up to speed. February 13th, 2017, when Derek German arrived to pick the girls up, they were not there. Not long after, a search party formed and began searching for the missing girls. The community pitched in, as did many local law enforcement agencies. A full force search began looking for Abby and Libby. The official search was called off later that night without success, a controversial decision at the time. The areas around the bridge had been searched, but it was a large area spanning rough terrain and several acres, and the sunlight was quickly fading. The search resumed the following day, Valentine's Day, February 14th, and by 12:15 p.m. that afternoon, the bodies of Abby and Libby were discovered in the woods, about a quarter mile away from the high bridge by a volunteer in one of the search parties. The police were tight-lipped about most of the details surrounding the girls, their cause of death, what the crime scene looked like, and more. However, they did release the Snapchat evidence as well as a few sketches of what they thought Bridge Guy may look like. For the next several years, law enforcement would struggle to find a break in the case. Despite several sketches, audio and video of the killer, nothing was working.
I don't know if you remember this or not, but they released kind of the initial sketch of Bridge Guy, and I believe that was the sketch where he was wearing, you know, like a little like cap. I forget what they call it, like a driving cap or whatever. And, you know, he had like a goatee, looked a little chubby or heavier set, and that was kind of the sketch that went around for a while. And then I don't know if you remember or not, but they then, several years later, they changed course and they released an updated sketch, and it was like totally different than the original sketch. And it was like a younger looking guy with like poofy, right, curly hair. It was just, it was wild. And there's just so much speculation going on everywhere, like all over the internet, podcasts, everywhere, right? Like nobody knew anything about what had happened that day. And it was just, you know, it was really tough. It's a small community. No one knew, like, was this somebody who lived here? Was it somebody who was just like transient who happened to be there that day, you know, looking for trouble, or, you know, what was actually going on? So it was a wild series of events.
And to the credit to law enforcement agency, you know, the images that they did release, they were very, very poor quality. So, you know, it was very difficult to, you know, create that initial sketch. And like you said, it was wild that, you know, the second composite that they came up with looked completely different, you know. And I think they, you know, obviously throughout, you know, steps of the investigation, you know, I think they probably went down several rabbit holes. And, you know, some of the information we'll share here soon too is, you know, one of those rabbit holes and how they came to the, that second composite, you know, which was leading them to believe that it, you know, potentially could have been a younger person than initially suspected.
Yeah, and Indiana State Police Superintendent Carter was, you know, he held a press conference, and they announced, you know, a whole new direction in the case. And, you know, that's where they had decided, you know, we're going to go release this new sketch and, you know, shared it with the public and what have you, and, you know, see if they could drum up anything additional, you know, outside of what they were already finding. You know, and they weren't sharing a ton of information, you know, like they had Libby's phone. They had a lot more than what they were giving. And quite honestly, like, you know, a lot of people will get really frustrated by that. But there are so many times that you can go read about a case and law enforcement is trying to keep stuff, you know, close to the chest, and then it somehow gets out or they say too much. And then it really muddies the waters when it comes to narrowing down actual legitimate suspects, because you got to remember, in a case like this, if they don't have DNA evidence, which we don't know, you know, they didn't tell us, but if they don't have any DNA evidence, they have to be able to prove without a reasonable doubt that the person that they ultimately make their suspect, you know, that they were the person that was there. And the only real way to do that is by leaving a lot of information behind that only the killer would know. And so when they get into the interrogation phase, they can get that information and then say, see, the public didn't know this, this, and this, but this person did. you know, that would put them here. And so that's what they're trying to do. And while that's really frustrating to the public, and especially after several years go by, it's one of those things where if they don't do that, it really jeopardizes their case. And they knew that. And so, like, in hindsight, in this case, like, knowing the outcome now, I will say, like, I commend the way they conducted this investigation. Were there mistakes? Sure. They're human. But the way that they did this and the way they were able to keep things quiet, knowing what was at stake, the high profile nature of this case, you couldn't ask for them to do a better job. Because ultimately, I mean, we'll talk about it in a little bit. One of the mistakes they make is actually overlooking the suspect,
right,
that they eventually arrest. But
I was going to say, I would commend them on the investigation as well. I know there had to be a ton of frustration, especially from, you know, friends and family of Abby and Libby. And, you know, why is it taking so long? I'm sure there was that sense of urgency that was just driving them crazy. But in hindsight, like you said, you know, there was, they tried to keep everything as tight-lipped as possible so there wouldn't be that speculation, or there wouldn't be facts released that would muddy up the investigation and take them down different avenues of research, yeah, or investigation that, you know, it made the investigation overall just that much longer.
Right, right. So let's talk about the suspects a little bit and kind of who police were targeting, you know, throughout the investigation.
There weren't many suspects during the investigation, but there were a couple worth mentioning. First suspect being Ronald Logan. Logan was the owner of the land where the bodies of Abby and Libby were found. Police investigated Logan, but he was never charged. A search warrant cited complaints that he was abusive, violent towards women, and owned weapons. The violence against women claim would be backed up by a former girlfriend who accused Logan of physical abuse. Logan later died in 2020 due to complications from COVID.
Yeah, he was an interesting character, Ron Logan. So where Abby and Libby's bodies are found, they're like in this area of around Deer Creek, and like, you know, so you have the Monon High Bridge area, but then there was like this plot of land that kind of like that was kind of in the area, and that's where it starts to become his property, and that's where the girls are found. So logically, everyone's kind of like, well, hey, did you ever like take a look at Ron Logan? You know? And so they start investigating him.
The next suspect we are looking at is Keegan Klein. While investigators were combing through the digital records of the girls to see what connections they could make, they came across a person who was interacting with Libby. He was going by the online persona of Anthony Schatz. Using photographs of a known male model, Klein was using this fake account to solicit nude photos from underage girls. Klein had been discovered because he was interacting with Liberty German close to the time of her death. Klein was later arrested for child exploitation, possession of child pornography, which was discovered during a raid of his home in February of 2017. Authorities discovered numerous explicit images and videos of minors on his electronic devices. Obstruction of justice. Klein allegedly deleted files and app data to hinder the investigation before his devices were seized. Communicating with minors. Authorities alleged that Klein communicated with numerous underage girls using his fake profile, requesting sexually explicit content and engaging in predatory behavior. Klein was 22 at the time of this investigation. Then in 2020, after years of investigation, Klein is arrested and charged with 30 felony counts, including child exploitation, possession of child pornography, and obstruction of justice. Klein has been sentenced for his involvement in child exploitation and related offenses. In May 2023, he received a 40-year prison sentence after pleading guilty to 25 felony charges, including child exploitation, possession of child pornography, and obstruction of justice. In June 2024, the Indiana Court of Appeals upheld Klein's 40-year sentence, rejecting his appeal for a reduced term.
Yeah, that dude was a total scumbag. And I don't know if you recall or not, but there was also a, you know, an Indiana State Police like bulletin put out looking for information from him. And let's just take a quick listen to that.
My name is Sergeant Jeremy Pierce, the public information officer with the Indiana State Police out of the Lafayette Post. While investigating the murders of Abigail Williams and Liberty German, detectives with the Carroll County Sheriff's Office and the Indiana State Police have uncovered an online profile named Anthony Schatz. This profile was being used from 2016 to 2017 on social media applications, including but not limited to Snapchat and Instagram. The fictitious Anthony Schatz profile used images of a known male model and portrayed himself as being extremely wealthy and owning numerous sports cars. The creator of the fictitious profile used this information while communicating with juvenile females to solicit nude images, obtain their address, and attempt to meet with them. Pictured on your screen, you'll see images of the known male model and images of the fictitious profile sent to the underage females. We have already identified the male in these images that were used by Anthony Schatz. The male in the photo is not the person of interest in the investigation. Detectives are seeking information about the person who created the Anthony Schatz profile. Investigators would like any individual who communicated, met, or attempted to meet the Anthony Schatz profile to contact law enforcement by utilizing the tip email, abbyandlibbytip@cacoshrf.com. Please provide as much information as you possibly can. For example, when you communicated with Anthony Schatz, how you communicated with the profile, what social media applications the account used, and if Anthony Schatz attempted to meet you or obtain your address. If you have saved images or conversations with Anthony Schatz's profile, please attach them to your email. Again, if you have any information, please contact law enforcement by utilizing the tip email, abbyandlibbytip@cacoshrf.com. Thank you.
Yeah, so the good news is that in all of this, that scumbag was captured and arrested and put in jail for a long-ass time. But the bad news is that these girls were lost in that process. But that piece of trash was put in the slammer, you know, right away. So that it's just disgusting, right? Like, and again, it kind of goes back to, like, as parents, you really can't just, like, let your kids loose on the internet as much as we want to. You just can't. And this is why people like that, right? Not to say that, you know, Abby or Libby was, you know, sending, you know, derogatory pictures of themselves to this guy or anything. Like, we don't know that. It could have just been they kind of came across each other somehow and then just started chatting or whatever. And it was, you know, it never turned into anything, or they didn't have enough time for it to turn into anything before they passed away. But it's just one of those things. It freaks you out, yeah, as a parent.
You're absolutely honestly right. Even in the last 5 years since we've last spoke on, you know, this show, the threat is out there. The threat is real. It's crazy how much of this is going on, you know, online, social media apps, you know, what have you. And having younger children myself, you know, you're constantly burdened with that, making sure that they're safe, that they don't fall trap or, you know, fall for any of this stuff that's going on online, because it's just truly terrible. And like you said, it's really good that obviously this guy was an obvious suspect, you know, based on this activity. And it's good that he got what was coming to him. And I'm also happy to see that he's locked away, mm-hmm, for 40 years. What'd we say? He was 22, 23 at the time of arrest and conviction. So he's not going to see the light of day until he's an old man. And hopefully at that point, you know, hate to say it, but I don't wish ill will on anyone, but hopefully he doesn't see the light of day again.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.
I don't wish ill will on anyone, but I wish ill will on
absolutely.
Child predators, for sure. No, I mean, and that's usually why they get their prison justice. You know, like, even the criminals are like, yeah, fuck that guy.
Yep. He has a long, hard 40 years of the rest of his life to think about it, if he makes it that long.
Yeah, I mean, that guy is disgusting, obviously. But yeah, let's move into the next one. So we had Daniel Nations. And I kind of remember Daniel Nations coming up on the radar. I don't know if you remember that or not, but it was like kind of a hot thing for a minute when he got arrested. It was, I believe he was arrested in Colorado. And that spurred this whole comparison of him to the sketches that were out there of Bridge Guy. And Nations was arrested in Colorado for threatening hikers with a hatchet near a trail system in the Monument area. And it occurred on the same day another man was fatally shot near the same trail. And it started to raise suspicion due to the proximity to the hiking trails and the violent nature of the incidents that were reminiscent of the Delphi murders. So, again, guy kind of looked like Bridge Guy from the sketch, was violent, and people started kind of trying to put two and two together. His general build and facial features were noted as potential matches to the Bridge Guy, and he had a violent criminal history, including domestic violence and indecent exposure. So, you know, and finally, he was connected to Indiana. He previously lived there, and he may have been in the area during the time. So, you know, people started looking into it. Obviously, Indiana State Police ran an investigation after he was arrested in Colorado. You know, he was investigated as a person of interest in the Delphi case, and authorities interviewed him and examined all the potential evidence, and ultimately they cleared him as a suspect. The police, you know, stated there was no evidence tying him to the crime scene or the murders of Abby and Libby, and his association with the case was just based on circumstantial similarities that really didn't hold up once they investigated him further. So, you know, I don't know. Do you remember when that went off? I kind of remember following that on social media.
Yeah, I don't recall a lot of the facts, but I do remember there was, you know, someone that was under being questioned at the time, you know, due to the physical, you know, appearance and similarities and mannerisms that were captured in that, you know, down the hill audio and video from the girl's phone.
Yeah, he did look. I mean, he was a pretty good ringer for the sketch, if I'm honest. But it is another crazy aspect of modern society is like the sort of like witch hunt that people go on to try to find, you know, prolific criminals, you know, and try to tie them to things online, right? And you get the mob mentality of the internet coming at you. And then we go from there. So, you know, it's always interesting, but
yeah,
you know, here we are.
I was going to say, I don't think that him being investigated and cleared as a suspect was, you know, out of line by law enforcement because there were so many similarities there, you know, the domestic violence, the attack with the hatchet, and I think he was also arrested for indecent exposure. So, I mean, there were pieces of that puzzle that lined up that, you know, obviously he was a potential suspect.
Yeah, and it was one of those things where, hey, maybe we found something here. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. Do you want to talk about sort of kind of like wrap this up to how we ultimately end up at our suspect?
Sure. Over 2,000 days would pass until finally a break in the case. A volunteer file clerk, Kathy Shank, noticed a lead sheet that had marked someone named Richard Allen as cleared. She felt that the significance of his admission to being on the bridge that day was too much to ignore. She alerted the detectives, which allowed them to begin re-examining Richard Allen. As it turned out, Allen spoke to authorities on February 16, 2017. He admitted to being on the bridge that day, but didn't provide any incriminating evidence, and his tip was logged and marked as cleared. In October of 2022, detectives re-interviewed Allen. He admits to being on the trail that day, which leads investigators to obtain a search warrant, and they go through his home. They collect evidence at the scene, such as a gun, a .45 caliber 6-hour P226 linked to an unspent bullet found at the crime scene. On October 28, 2022, Richard Allen is booked into the Carroll County, Indiana jail in connection with the Delphi murders. On Halloween 2022, Richard Allen was officially arrested in connection with the murders of Abby Williams and Libby German. Allen pleaded not guilty and remained at the White County jail, where he was detained without bond.
Yeah, and so you know, Kathy Shank was just going through and refiling some stuff related to the case, and she was just like, something just doesn't feel right, and, you know, alerts police. And that was kind of in reference to what I was saying earlier. Like, this was a mistake by police, essentially, because they already interviewed him and they marked him clear, you know, and turns out, you know, hey, here he is right under our nose. And I think Doug Carter, when he was at one of the press conferences, even says something to the effect of, we've likely already talked to you or someone close to you. and sure enough, they did.
He absolutely did say that in his press conference. And what a sickening feeling. But in the end, what a relief, you know, to come across that, what that file clerk came across and, you know, raised a suspicion and brought him back in. Because had that not happened, we still may be talking about this case as unresolved at this point.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And one thing that's mentioned in here, right, that we didn't know until this point. Well, and even then, I don't know if we knew this until the trial, to be honest with you, but I threw that in here, is, you know, they collected a gun with a 45 caliber 6 RP226 that was linked to an unspent bullet found at the crime scene. So that was something that we didn't really know, which was that there was a gun used and a bullet found, all related to this whole murder of these children, right? And we didn't know that. They didn't share that information with us. So no one had any idea, right? Again, back to, like, how can we link somebody to this without having DNA, you know, if we don't have it? Again, we still didn't know that they didn't have DNA. We do find that out during the trial. They didn't really have any DNA evidence that tied anybody to this. So, again, it makes a ton of sense why they're holding back a bunch of information like this, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, that is an interesting piece of the investigation. I would love to know how they, and I'm not trying to be a defense attorney here, but I would love to know how they link the unspent bullet to his specific 45 caliber gun in this case, because we're talking about a 5-year span of time.
Yeah, it's a we'll talk about this in a future episode of covering the actual trial, because they do go into that quite a bit. And, you know, all I'll say here is that quote unquote science of how they, you know, kind of fingerprint bullets and link them to guns is up for debate within the community. Like, no one says for sure that that is a guarantee that evidence, you know, that they actually can truly do that and link things. I think it's sort of along the lines of a polygraph, right? Where it's like, it can point us in the right direction. It's not necessarily a guarantee. And, you know, they talked about that later, and I guess I'll kind of dive into it a little bit here. But one of the things that they do is they will put like a round in a gun and shoot it out of the actual gun, you know, from that's collected, and then compare that to, you know, a lot of times they'll compare it to casings they find or shells and say like, okay, well, this gun left these impressions and they match the ones we found at the crime scene, da 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 da. In this case, right, it's an unspent round. So, and we'll go into great detail about this, you know, later, like I said. But the one other thing I want to mention is, you know, as part of the pushback against this, you know, science, one of the things that they say that tends to kind of push this into a weird direction is, if you buy this, say, Sig Sauer gun at a gun store near Delphi, right, somebody else could buy the same model gun at another gun store nearby. And in all likelihood, these two guns are going to be very, very similar anyway, because when they manufacture those lots, those same lots tend to ship to the same locations or similar locations. So maybe, like, geographically speaking, you have a pretty wide area where all of the guns are manufactured around the same exact time, with the same equipment, with the same parts, on the same days. And so they all have a very similar assembly method, right? And then maybe that would change when you have a different, you know, lot of guns, and then those go to a different geographic area. But again, those in the same geographic area tend to be similar, but they might then differ from the ones that were shipped to that other geographic area. So that's where you could find the differences. So I found that interesting. You know, there was an expert that testified about this during the trial, and that part was fascinating to me. I don't know. Again, like, I'm not a gun expert. I don't know how true any of all that is, but it sounds somewhat logical to me that that could be the case.
It does for sure. And I'm really looking forward to when we get into the very descriptive details of the trial, and some of these key points come up. You know, as you can see, there's a lot of investigation. I know the trial went on for, you know, quite some time, so I'm really looking forward to sharing that information, dissecting it, and, you know, analyzing it further.
Yeah, I mean, in order to get there, I felt like we should go through this all again, right, briefly, just so we could get to that point. And in that vein, you know, let's talk about some things that happened, you know, leading up to the trial. So on November 1st, 2022, Libby's grandmother said that Richard Allen worked at the local CVS store as a pharmacy tech. He had printed photos of the girls for the funeral and gave them to her for free. This is the only known interaction between the suspected killer and their families. However, the town is only 3,000 people, so it's likely they may have interacted in the past. I read that. I had not heard that before, and I came across this while researching the case, and that just blew my mind.
That absolutely blows my mind. Can you even imagine? I mean, the balls of the guy to give them the photos for free, and he is right. The one, you know. Wow. It just blows my mind. And the sinking pit in Libby's grandmother's stomach to learn that later on.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And like, I'm sure there's instances where there's like run-ins like this, but it's just, I mean, it has to be pretty rare that you interact with what was really a total stranger, right? And that stranger murdered your children, but then you interact with this stranger randomly. You know, like, it just, the way that it all happened was so bizarre, you know, and, oh man, I would, could you imagine?
I cannot imagine. That like, is just a crazy piece of information.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, November 22nd, 2022, Allen was granted a bail hearing. On November 29th, unsealed court records detailed that cell phone video and an unspent bullet were what led authorities to arrest Allen. So that's where we sort of learn a little bit about that. And then we move along to April 6th of 2023, and Allen's legal team, attorneys Andrew Baldwin and Bradley Rossi, filed an emergency motion to modify the safekeeping order issued by the judge. This order is meant to keep a suspect in safe condition so that they can make it to trial. In Allen's case, this meant that he was held in solitary confinement. You know, the trial talks about this a lot, so we'll dive in deep there. But one thing that I did find quite interesting, so Judge Frances Gall, who oversaw this case, she ordered this safekeeping order, right? And as part of that, they decided to put him in, you know, basically like a supermax facility in solitary confinement. And like, he's not charged with, or he's not guilty, you know, he's not found guilty yet, you know, or anything. So to me, it is kind of strange in a way that they're able to do that, because, you know, that's a pretty, we all know, like, being held in solitary is a pretty extreme condition. Nobody likes it. It goes all against human nature.
Yeah, absolutely. But, I mean, with the evidence to that point in the case and with the magnitude of the crime, with him being the chief suspect at this point, you know, I can see where the judge is trying to protect him, because, you know, we alluded to it earlier, child pedophilia and all of that is just terrible. And a lot of those people actually get their day in court and retribution in prison from other prisoners. And then just the heinous act of him, the gruesome killings of these two girls, you know, he may have never made it to trial if he was in general population.
Yeah. I mean, that's the weird part of it all, right? Like, I agree with that completely, but at the same time, to me, that's also something that you can't or should you be, the question is, should you be able to control that? That's the question. Like, where do your rights end? Even though you're accused of something, you're not found guilty of it yet at this point, you know, or innocent for that matter, you know? So where do my rights stop? and it's an interesting point. But we still have a lot to get through here, so I want to move along. And, you know, on June 13th, 23, Allen's defense team files a motion to suppress ballistics evidence. You know, obviously, if ballistics is what tied them, you know, him to the crime scene, trying to get them to suppress that would be a pretty big win for them. You know, it would stop a lot of things from happening. And on June 15th, Allen was in court for a bail hearing, and during that time, they covered several topics, including the fact that Allen confessed 5 or 6 times, but his attorneys argued that he couldn't be trusted due to his mental state, which would be correlated to being kept in solitary confinement. And then they also asked that he be moved from Westville Correctional Facility to a county jail, citing a decline in his mental health. And then on June 16th, his defense team claimed that his mental and physical state were worsening in isolation. And on June 29th, Judge Francis Gall unsealed 118 documents in the case against Allen. Allen allegedly told his wife and mother no less than 5 times that he was responsible for killing the girls. This also showed that the investigators believed a knife was used in the killings. And, you know, one big interesting slash odd point here is on September 18th, 2023, there is a theory brought by the defense related to Odinist cult killing. And so they announced this alternative theory and claimed that it was a ritualistic murder by the occult. The judge said that it was unfounded and that they had absolutely no proof. And the defense claimed the investigators spoke with key suspects whom the defense team believed were at the center of the cult theory. I find that like absolutely batshit crazy. Because, I mean, really, how many actual cult killings do we know of, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I know we have some future cases that are going to, you know, go that direction, but actual true cult killings, I don't know. You know, you hear conversations and, you know, taboo conversations about, you know, one of the most famous ones was the Manson cult, but Manson didn't actually kill anybody.
Yeah.
It was his followers, you know.
No.
That's one of the most prolific ones for sure. Yep. But aside from that, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it's just not a thing that really, I think, actually happens. It's kind of like the satanic panic thing, right? And the defense is trying their damnedest to like throw these theories in there. But just briefly, like talking about Odinism, you know, Odinism, for those who don't know, and I didn't know either, so I'm not calling you stupid if you didn't know, because I had to look it up, and it is a white supremacist cult focused on the worship of the Norse god Odin. The belief system may also sometimes be referred to as Asatru and is centered around white supremacist beliefs combined with magical elements of neo-paganism. Values in both groups center around the idea of folk tribes and individualism. Many of the elements of Norse culture and belief used in Odinism were also used by Nazi leadership to promote its ideology. So, yeah, I don't really have any more to add to that, but just wanted to kind of give a background on what that actually means. In terms of what the defense was saying, you know, they were alleging that investigators consulted with a professor regarding possible Odinism signatures at the crime scene, but failed to produce a report or identify the professor to the defense. And they claim that investigators failed to provide information regarding Brad Holder, an Odinist in the area whose son was reportedly dating Williams. And there was a quote that Brad Holder posted on social media, images mimicking the very runes found at the crime scene, a crime scene unreleased and unknown to the general public, even to this day, the filing reads. And it continues on, the defense believes that the court will be shocked at the number of clues or Easter eggs, both before and after the murders, that Holder openly posted on his Facebook page that pointed the finger to his involvement in the murders. Which, again, I don't have much of an opinion around that. I don't know if you have anything you want to add there.
Like you said, a little batshit crazy and kind of a wild swing by the defense on this, but interesting that Holder posted the images, you know, mimicking the ruins and similar to what was found at the crime scene, and that was unreleased to the public. But, you know, how much merit do you put in that, honestly?
Not a lot. I really don't. And it's one of those things where, you know, I feel like this is, you've got your client, you know, confessing to the killings, and it becomes increasingly more difficult to, you know, defend against that if you have somebody saying they did it,
right.
You know? So I think they've got to think big, right? They got to go big picture here and try and find something, anything.
Yeah, absolutely. So now we'll look at the evidence that the defense is claiming links the Odinists to the murders. The main evidence allegedly connecting the crime to Odinists includes the positioning of the girls' bodies in sticks and marks at the crime scene. The defense team says resemble runes, which are associated with Norse culture and religion. With respect to the position of the bodies, the defense claims the position of William's body echoes that of a painting titled Odin Hanging from World Tree. The filing calls the painting evidence of an additional dark, demonic component to Odinism, at least of articles concerning Odinist human sacrifice and imagery found on the internet. Lawyers cited imagery online of, quote, a man hanging upside down from a tree who has been sliced in the neck with blood dripping to the ground. This man's arms are posed similarly to Abby's at the crime scene. This man's legs are also posed similarly to Abby's at the crime scene. His left leg is straight and his right leg is bent at the knee. The only difference is the man's right leg is placed over the left leg, while Abby's right leg was posed under the left leg. On September 4th, 2024, Judge Gull ruled out the defense leveraging the Odinism theory.
Yeah, and so, you know, that's kind of a theme that runs through into the trial, you know, that the defense keeps trying to push this theory. But again, you know, it's based on a lot of circumstantial things, nothing really factual, and I think that's why Judge Gall ruled it out. I think I would have made the same ruling, too, if I were a judge. But, you know, God help you guys if I ever become a judge. But yeah, so the next thing that I found really crazy is there was an evidence leak. So on October 5th, 2023, evidence related to German and Williams' death, including crime scene photos, were leaked online and distributed to true crime YouTubers and podcasters. On October 9th, 2023, Mitch Westerman, a friend of one of the defense attorneys, contacted Baldwin and admitted to the leak. He took photos of the evidence and sent them to a man who shared them with another person from Texas. Then they were sent to the aforementioned content creators. On October 19th, 2023, Baldwin and Razi voluntarily withdrew from the case in response to the evidence leak. This meant parts of the pretrial process would start over as Allen awaited a new defense team. On October 26th, Baldwin and Razi filed several motions with the Indiana Supreme Court claiming they were removed from the murder case by Gull in the aftermath of the leak. On November 22nd, Mitchell Westerman, 41, who was accused of leaking the crime scene evidence in October, was arrested and charged with one count of conversion, a Class A misdemeanor. And on January 18th, 2024, the Indiana Supreme Court reinstated the original defense team. So this was crazy because what had happened is this guy, he was a friend of the defense attorney, and I believe it was Brad Razi. If memory serves, I could be wrong, so don't hold me to that. But he was a friend of them. He was there. Razi, I believe, would later mention in an interview that like he was a trusted advisor kind of person. So like as he was like he there was a gag order on the case, right? So like they couldn't talk about the case really anywhere besides internally with themselves. Now obviously they could talk to other people. They just couldn't like go to the media and have, you know, basically duke this out in the media, like smearing thing, you know, spreading smear campaigns on each side and this and that. So they had to kind of keep it quiet in that regard, but they were allowed to talk to other people. So he claims like Mitch was an advisor, somebody he trusted to like talk to talk out aspects of the case and work through things. And, you know, at the end of the day, this guy did what he did, stole/snapped photos of crime scene photos and leaked them. Then there was like a YouTube channel that covers true crime and they got a hold of them. And it was just kind of a weird dramatic event. You know, if you want to look into it further, you should. It's kind of fascinating. And there's a pretty long interview where the defense team kind of talks through this at length. And what I came away with was, in my opinion, like the defense attorney is just, he's a chode. like straight up. Like, I don't know. He just came off as such a dick. And he almost seemed like he was faking remorse for what was happening. And I just don't believe it, like, at all.
Yeah. And it could have all been a ruse as well. I mean, like you said, he could have been faking it and just in an attempt to, you know, draw on any kind of sympathy he could get at all. Ultimately, like you said, they all voluntarily withdrew from the case in response to the leak. So that to me is an admission of guilt, but that's just me too.
Yeah, it's really strange. Yeah, so following the evidence leak, you know, there was a lot of drama there, but, you know, then we went through a lot of the pretrial hearings, you know, kind of standard procedure type stuff. And ultimately, we end up with, you know, a trial date that would happen in October of 2024, which we will cover on the backside of this episode in part two. So that being said, you know, I think that's a good stopping point for us for today. Was there anything else you wanted to wrap up with?
No, I am looking forward to picking back up with the trial and really getting into the very detailed information that was all part of the trial.
Yes, sir. Well, that being said, you know, thanks for listening to this bounce back episode of Killer Podcast. If you would, do us a huge favor and subscribe to the show on your podcast platform of choice. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, I believe iHeart. There's a lot of places that the show exists. So, you know, find us, subscribe to us, and, you know, then drop us a line. You can find us on Threads at Killer Podcast and slash Instagram for that matter. And on X, I believe that's one at Killer _ Podcast. And cause some dick took Killer Podcast from us. And you could also go to our website, killerpodcast.org, sign up for our Patreon page. There you can listen to the back catalog ad-free. And also as part of this, you'll get some, I guess, off-the-cuff episodes where Craig and I might, you know, discuss true crime and then some. So you could catch those episodes there as well. And we really appreciate you guys for listening. Make sure you subscribe, tell somebody, share us with your friends. We like to party, so pass us around. Any final words, Craig?
No, just thanks for listening, as David said, and pass along the word. As we get back into the loop here, hopefully we'll start gaining some more momentum and quality of the shows will improve as we continue on.
Yes, sir. All right, everybody. Stay safe.
Zaxby's Sensation Salad is so much more than a plain old salad. It's a salad, which begs the question, at what point does a salad stop being a salad and become a salad? Is it when you add Zaxby's fried chicken to it? Crunchy wontons? Asian slaw? Citrus vinaigrette? Teriyaki glaze? Sweet and spicy sauce? Or is it when you top it all with a handmade perfectly fried egg roll? Without a doubt, the egg roll. The Sensation Salad, only at Zaxby's.